Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome. This is Genuinely Grace with the Alcohol Free Life podcast, and I hope you're doing okay wherever you are, and however you're coping on week. I've lost track. Is it five? I think. It's been a reasonably okay week. I've actually been so busy. I haven't had time to. ruminate too much. I've had a lot going on. I'm still doing my BBC shows. I'm able to do that from home. So that's really good. And actually, we had a great guest on the Radio 2 show in the week, Alan Botton. I love his work. Absolutely love him. A philosopher, of course, and best-selling author. And he's great at sort of giving a sense of perspective on everything. And during the interview, he was sort of sharing that something that I've been saying a lot lately, in that, you know, we should not be beating ourselves up at this time. You know, we should not be telling ourselves that we need to do stuff if we don't feel that we want to, basically. And he gave us this little kind of 6-point plan to help us reduce anxiety that we might be feeling. So number one, he says, concede. So accept, you know, don't try and fight the current situation. Number two, love. Hold out a hand to other people who are scared and confused. You know, we know about that. Friendships around shared vulnerability, which is really lovely. Number three is serve. So take a holiday from the grueling search for self-fulfillment and focus on that more gratifying task of helping other people where you can. Yeah, I love that. I mean, what's my thing? Reach out to someone else, because acts of kindness bring more to you than they do to the recipient. So I love that, number three. Number four is interesting. Pessimism. It says, gain peace of mind not by expecting the best, but by scoping out the very worst and make yourself at peace in its grimiest corners. Now, there's something that we don't say very much, do we? That's something my old dad used to say. My old dad, late dad, used to say, "Oh well, if you always expect the worst, then then you know how bad can it be?" I must admit, I can't buy into that. I would say be realistic, of course, be realistic. But actually, I would say always expect the best. There you go, Alan. I disagree with you for once. But the others I love. Number five, laughter. Laugh at the absurdity of the situation we're in, and insist on defiant humour. And number six, I totally 100% agree with, small pleasures. Take all of this one day at a time and keep a special place for modest pleasures like the sight of flowers, chocolate and the sunshine. And that's so completely true. Alan runs the School of Life, by the way, if you haven't checked out his work before. He's absolutely awesome. I love the stuff he does. And he's totally right. The small pleasures. How grateful are we for the sunshine? It's been amazing this week. It's meant that I haven't got anything like as much done than I've been telling myself I should be doing. But, you know, as I say to you guys all the while, we have to stop the shoulding. I have some great guests for you this week. We've teamed up with Binary Drinks. This is this drink that I mentioned to you a while ago, because it's so unusual. It's a really unusual alcohol-free drink. So I'm going to be interviewing Danielle Becker from Binary Drinks. We're going to be talking about this unusual sort of concoction that's really lovely, refreshing alcohol-free drink to have in the sunshine. And then before that, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Arik Sigmund. Now, how do I even begin to describe him? Well, I'll describe him when I introduce him on the interview, because obviously I pre-recorded it a week or so ago. But I've known Arik for a lot of years. I've heard him speak many times. Most of his work is around parenting, you know, aimed at sort of parents, and he does talks in schools and stuff. He's really has a unique take on everything, and is a scientist. So, you know, he spends his life researching the stuff that he talks about. So he's a fascinating guest, and he's going to be talking about alcohol and the role that alcohol plays in the lives of teenagers. And there's a lot there for us as parents, those of us who are parents, as to how we can navigate the whole issue of alcohol with our kids as they grow up. But even if you're not a parent, don't switch off, because he has some fantastic insights and some really interesting stuff to share. So I really hope you'll enjoy the interview with Aric. Just before that, I just want to let you know as well that I've got I've come up with a little free mini ebook, a PDF effectively. But it's quite fun. It's got some quite nice tips and questions you can ask yourself. So if you'd like a copy of that, it's called How to Get and Stay Sober During Lockdown, well, and beyond. If you go to thesoberclub.com and click on blog posts, you'll see the link there. Or you can go to the show notes for this episode. So just check out the show notes and that will give you a direct link there to access the download. Or you can look at the Facebook page, Jane Lee Grace Loves, and you'll see a link for it there. So it's called How to Get and Stay Sober During Lockdown. It won't take you long to read. And there's a few fun graphics on there. And it's, you know, it's just, it came about just because I was getting a lot of people saying to me, well, one of two things, either that they're drinking more than they want to. They're normally, you know, relatively okay with drinking, but they're finding it's really ramping up. And of course, we know that alcohol sales are literally, they've gone through the roof, I've heard. So there's a lot of people really, really recognizing that this is not good for their mental health at this time. And then there are a lot of other people who, you know, even members of the Sober Club, who found that after feeling that they're very solid in their sobriety, suddenly the wine witch comes calling because these are such unusual times. So I thought I'd put a few thoughts down, give you a few little pertinent questions to ask yourself. So it's just a free kind of mini ebook. And as I say, you can go to thesoberclub.com, click on the blog posts and you'll see it there. Or you can look at the show notes for this episode. Or you can go to Facebook. So I hope you enjoy that. Oh, and one more thing to tell you. I'm actually a guest this week on the Love Sober podcast. It was really lovely to connect with Mandy and Kate and to be on the other side of the microphone. The podcast Love Sober, of course, has been going longer than this one, I think. So, it was great to be their guest. So have a listen to that if you want to, know a little bit more about my personal story. But also we chat quite a lot about various things in that podcast. You might find it interesting. So check out the Love Sober podcast. Without further ado, then, let me bring you Dr. Aric Sigman.
He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Biology, associate fellow of the British Psychological Society, and a chartered scientist awarded by the Science Council. He's also the author of 5 books on health and development topics. I first came across Aric when he came to speak at a school where my kids were attending on the tricky topic of kids and alcohol. Welcome, Aric. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I really appreciate it because you have such a wealth of knowledge around, as you say, you know, health and well-being, developmental issues for children and teenagers. And a book that you wrote a while ago was called Alcohol Nation, How to Protect Our Children from Today's Drinking Culture. Let's just talk a bit about that. Now, that book came out a while ago, didn't it? And I'll be first off, really interested to know the kind of main premise of the book. But then I'd be really interested to know how you think it's changed in the years since the first publication of that.
Well, you can tell from my accent that I don't come from England. I'm foreign, I'm American. And if you happen to be a child and I was your parent in America, I could give you a gun in many states. Many of my friends had guns when I was a child. But Janie, you wouldn't be allowed to have, although you could have a gun, you couldn't have a glass of beer or any alcohol whatsoever until you're 21. You can't have it at home. You can't buy it at an off license. You can't go to a bar or a pub or anything of the sort. I came to England and I came to realize that the legal drinking age in this country is still 5 years old.
Is that right?
Yes, is it? Is.
Wow.
We rely upon, parents being responsible and not handing glasses of vodka or whiskey sours to their 5-year-old kids. But you can see there's a major cultural difference. You can't have guns. You can't have alcohol. And the drinking age and the drinking culture is very, very different here. The way I see drunkenness portrayed in dramas, self-medicating adults, I could just kill for a glass of wine when they get home from work. It is a very different thing, especially in front of children. Now, there has been a greater awareness of the role of alcohol in children's lives, but there's still a long way to go. And one of the main obstacles I've noticed in the intervening years is this persistent myth, and it is a myth, that the French are experts in teaching how children to drink and to prevent alcohol problems. I lecture at the Lycée School, the French school in Kensington, on alcohol to French children and their parents. And they're dismayed that the English have a misunderstanding of the way that they deal with alcohol. Secondly, the former approach of the French has now been entirely discounted. In other words, by trying to show children how to drink or teenagers how to drink, it isn't just a social learning process. It causes brain changes in addiction areas of the brain, making the alcohol more likely to be addictive, not less likely. And that still persists, that most parents in this country still don't realize that you can't teach your children to drink. And I'll go into more detail if you want, but that seems to be one of the main things, that we can protect our children from binge drinking and alcoholism by teaching them how to handle alcohol in a family setting when they're younger. It's just not true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm really glad you pointed that out. It's something that I've mentioned a few times on Alcohol Free Life podcast, is the fact that I went to a talk at my daughter's school. It's a different school to the one you came to speak at. And the conversation was around alcohol awareness. And there was a lot of discussion. Should we give children, these were sort of 12, 13, should we give children, you know, a little bit of alcohol with dinner to get them used to it? And I couldn't actually stop myself. I had to actually say, well, hold on, let's just replace the word for heroin. You know, would you be giving just a little bit of heroin with the dinner? You know, it's absolute nonsense. But I guess all of this just comes from the fact that, as you say, that our drinking culture in the UK is such that it is so normalized. It is, you know, what we do for celebration, commiseration every day, you know, lunchtime, play dates, everything. I mean, I don't even know what the answer to this is, but over time, have you seen that people are becoming more aware that this, it doesn't have to be the case for children? I mean, certainly from my perspective, I know that there has been a big movement, a big shift in certain numbers of people recognizing that that, you know, they can ditch the booze, they can choose to be mindful drinkers or not drink at all. But what about with parents, as you say, teaching their kids? Has anything changed?
There has been a slight change. And parents, once they realize, I have to say, the good thing is we know with health education that when their parents love their children, at least most of you do, and that when parents realize there's a new health issue and that they need to make some changes to protect their children, on the whole, they do it. Take a look at passive smoking. Take a look at seatbelts and many other things. Take a look at sun protection factors and sun lotions. Parents need the information. They love their kids. They make the changes. But the information hasn't been forthcoming with alcohol until recently. There's too much money at stake.
Yeah,
and the alcohol
industry
has played a very, very big role in being the main providers of information for parents. And if you want to take expert advice on obesity, you don't get it from the sugar industry, do you? You want to get expert advice on lung cancer, you don't get it from the tobacco industry. And when it comes to alcohol, you shouldn't be taking advice from the industry that makes the product. And that's what we've been doing in this country. And that's starting to shift now, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So there has been a shift, but I can go into really the consensus view on this right now. Mm. You rightly said, Janie, if we exchange the word alcohol, teaching our kids how to handle alcohol, with, for example, cocaine, would we want our children to be given lessons in sensible snorting at school? The idea being that if you get the coke into them early, they'll know how to handle it. We know that's not true, and the reason is this: that of course social learning is an important thing when it comes to drinking. And it's good that the French do introduce their children to alcohol, not in stand-up sawdust drinking institutions, but in family environments with food and grandparents and so on. All of that's very good, but we're still introducing the children to something which is biologically addictive. just like cocaine, just like heroin. And we fail to realize that, that the social learning doesn't trump the fact that it's still an addictive substance. And the main point is now this. You have, do you have blue eyes, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, you've got blue eyes, I've got brown eyes. Our genes gave us our eye color. Janie, unless you get a new eyeball, your eyeball colors are not going to change. That's the way it is. But addiction genes do change. Genes are not set in stone. We didn't know that before. And all of our children have addiction genes in their brain, and we want them to remain relatively dormant. We don't want them to be activated. And by allowing them to have alcohol during their early adolescent years, for example, or childhood, we can switch on those addiction genes, and it makes the alcohol far more rewarding and addictive than it would otherwise be. And that's the reason that experts now want the drinking ages to be delayed, to prevent those addiction genes from being switched on. They use the term, it's activating the neurocircuitry of addiction. And so children's brains are still developing until they're about 24 and a half, 25 years old. The younger they are, the more likely they are to have this addiction, these addiction genes switched on. And that's why it's important to delay the age at which our children start to drink alcohol. It will have long-term permanent effects on preventing addiction and binge drinking for the rest of their life. If we can just get them to hold on at least till the age of 16. That's the cutoff age they're talking about, bottom line age for having first drink.
Yeah. So do you find then that in the States, there is less, there are less children affected and teenagers affected because that drinking age is higher in the States? Or is it in fact that people, I mean, I've heard many Americans say that despite the drinking age being 21, they did find a way of, you know, having some cider behind the bike sheds or whatever.
They do. That's the difference. I think behind the bike shed and with difficulty and furtively is one thing. But the main point when you look across the world, and there are world studies on this, is that when societies make it more difficult for children to get alcohol, and they also disapprove of childhood drinking, you have less of a problem. And in America, they have many problems, all kinds of other health problems and gun problems and drug problems. Fewer alcohol problems. So, for example, tonight, there'll be about twice as many drunk 15-year-olds in this country as there would be in the United States. Mm. Not because American children are nicer or more well-behaved. They simply find it difficult to get the alcohol, and the police there are a lot more aggressive about it. Mm. The cops, I mean, some of the, you know, a lot of people have nothing but bad things to say about it, the American police. First thing, there's no such thing as the American police. There are 18,000 different police forces. But be that as it may, if they see teenagers walking down the street with a can of beer in their hand, they stop you and they make a real big fuss about it, and you don't talk back to them.
Yeah.
In this country, you can imagine, oh, would you kindly mind placing the alcoholic substance in the local rubbish bin? It's a very different culture. And that does make a difference in terms of alcohol consumption and ultimately alcohol problems amongst teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, this thing about the age, just to stay with that just for a moment, I remember that when I came to your talk many years ago, when my kids were young, at that point, I was still drinking. And so I was, you know, listening to the stuff you said very much on behalf of my kids and how to parent them responsibly. But I remember that you said, and you said this to the kids as well, and I think it hit home, you know, you actually said it is, you know, scientific that this will mess with your head, and, you know, at least till the age of, as you say, 20, 22, 23, whatever. And I don't know that many adults are aware of that fact, actually. I don't know if we realize that that we aren't fully, our brains aren't fully developed until that point.
In fact, there's new evidence that not fully developed till the age of 30, but be that as it may, one of the things that people don't fully take on board is that it's similar, funny enough, when I talk or publish medical papers on recreational screen time. People view drinking or computer gaming or social media purely as cultural phenomenon and arguments between generations, young people who like social media and old people who don't, or young people who like to get hammered and old people who don't want them to because it causes antisocial behavior. All of that may be true, Janie, but there's also a neurological dimension to this, which you rightly say people are not aware of. It's all about brains. That's why governments and the World Health Organization, the British government, the American government are all saying, please don't drink until you're older, and please don't ever binge drink, because the effects on the brain are now measurable. Mm. And that's why we're making a fuss about it. It's not because we don't want antisocial behavior. That's a different argument. Yeah. It's because it may cause changes which may be permanent in our children's brains.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me more about this concept of the addiction genes that we all have. I mean, I believe it or not, and it sounds to me, when I say it now, it sounds bonkers, but I genuinely didn't think of alcohol as being addictive. I thought, you know, years ago, I used to think that, okay, well, there are people who have an issue, and I'm not at rock bottom, but, you know, eventually I realized life is much better without any alcohol. But somehow I hadn't grasped that actually the substance is addictive. So tell me about the fact that about that alcohol is addictive, and explain to me about these addiction genes.
Right. Just to give you an idea, I have a separate laptop right next to me, and I've just got up a new study on the role of genes in addiction. Cool. And I'll just read it. This is from the journal called Current Psychiatry Reports, The Genetics of Alcoholism. And the conclusion is variations in genes, in other words, having different genes, are protective against both alcohol addiction and excessive consumption. In other words, that your genes can protect you against alcoholism, being addicted to alcohol, but also against binge drinking, because they're not the same thing. And they find two particular genes which strongly affect both consumption and dependence. So genes play a huge role. There's a term they use, Janie, in this called heritability. To what extent have you inherited your likelihood of becoming addicted to alcohol? 48% of what will make you an alcoholic is thought to come from your genes. The other 52% from your life circumstances, the friends you hang around with, do you live next door to a pub, etc. But genes play a huge role in this. It's not all about willpower or being immoral or irresponsible. Some people who are listening to this right now will have a 100% protection from ever becoming addicted to alcohol. It just can't happen. Other people with different genes, one night of heavy drinking, those genes are switched on, they're addictive. And we don't know who has what genes yet. There isn't just a single gene, it's probably a cluster of genes which operate differently in different people. But no two ways about it, genes play a huge and determining role into which one of us will be more likely to become an alcoholic or a binge drinker. Two different things, as you probably realize.
That's really interesting. So I often say, you know, I believe that I don't have an off switch when it comes to alcohol. So really what I'm really saying there is clearly I have some of these genes going down. So that if I start drinking, I'm not going to have just one, because I just don't have an off switch. I have an off switch with coffee. I can have a coffee. That's good. I'm satiated. I'm good. But not with alcohol. Yeah. So I guess that's what we're talking about.
It's exactly what we're talking about. And also, in addition to the fact that you probably have a genetic predisposition, we all know that alcohol is a disinhibitor. In other words, it prevents your brain, the controlling mechanisms, the impulse control areas of your brain are shut down. That's why we drink, because it lightens up our self-control. And you can see what happens. You have a couple of drinks. It prevents your impulse control mechanisms from working. It doesn't stop you from having the third and the fourth and the fifth. And so it's a feed forward situation. One leads to the other. That famous expression, where the man takes a drink, the man takes another drink, you could say woman, and then the drink takes the man. This is what happens.
Yeah,
you may be interested, Janie, to know that I've had the opposite problem from you. I've never been able to drink. I tried it when I was much
good
younger.
Good for you. That's brilliant.
If I have a quarter of a glass of wine, I will have a hangover in an hour and all the next day. And I have a brother and a mother who's fairly similar. The rest of my brothers and my father are entirely different. They could each drink a whole bottle of red wine, get up the next morning with no effects whatsoever. So even in my own family, I know that genes play a huge role. Mm. And you could never train me to be a drinker. It just can't happen.
Good. How lucky are you? But what's interesting
is...
I'm always
a designated driver, Janie. That's the problem.
No, trust me, you've got the better life. But what's interesting then is so given that we know then that there is part of this that is genetic, we also know that the other part, which often gets people started drinking as teenagers, it won't just be the genes kicking in. There will also be the fact that they try it on account of everyone else's. So it's the done thing, of course. And then it makes them suddenly feel, oh, wow, I am attractive to the opposite sex, or I am this, you know, so it tells you all sorts of stuff that, of course, isn't true. And of course, then, you know, the other bit is that when you're upset or you're fearful or whatever, it can, you know, happily numb you out for a bit. So in addition to the genes, we then have the ladening on of all the associations that, you know, that tell us that alcohol is a really good thing. And those associations, of course, become very deep rooted. And so over the years, people presumably use it to numb out. So it's complex, isn't it, all of this?
It is complex because, as you say, it interacts with emotions and it also interacts with culture. If you and I were talking about this in Saudi Arabia, we wouldn't need to talk about it because the culture would disapprove. And even in other countries like Turkey, which are, for example, Islamic countries, but are very Europeanized compared to others, even there, you don't see young people staggering around drunk on a Saturday night. Not because it's against the law. You can buy alcohol because culturally it's considered unacceptable to be slaughtered. And so culture plays a role in what you'll end up doing and what you'll end up drinking, as well as the emotional functions that alcohol can help you deal with. Mm. Yes, it is complicated. And what we don't want is for our children to learn to self-medicate, to use alcohol because they don't feel confident. Yes, it'll make them feel confident on Saturday night at a party. But do you want them to start relying upon alcohol to make them feel comfortable in social situations? And that's a question I'm going to leave all the listeners to decide whether they want. But you rightly pointed out that it starts to play an important emotional role at key stages of development. And we have to make sure that essentially they can face life without the alcohol and that the alcohol is a treat.
Well, I would argue with that, though. I would argue that alcohol is not a treat at all. And we have to teach kids that, you know, that it really isn't.
No, my point is that alcohol is not something that should be a given way of functioning
absolutely.
Coping with the world. That's what I really meant by it.
No, I get that completely. Exactly. And wouldn't it be great to live in a world where, you know, it's as normal to choose not to drink as it is to drink, rather than this thing that, again, a lot of teenagers have to face all the time is that sort of FOMO, isn't it? You know, everyone else is drinking, you're the odd one out. You've got to be quite strong as a teenager to be willing to actually say, well, you know, this doesn't suit me. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the stats, Eric, that actually quite a lot of millennials now are making the choice not to drink. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Those studies, which is fascinating.
There are more kids or young people being willing to say, no, I don't. And when I speak, and most of my week is spent speaking directly to children and then separately to their parents on this. Mm. And I say to the children, how many of you here hate the taste of Sprouts? And there's always a few that raise their hand. And I pick on someone and I say, right, you're at a party. Someone comes up and says, you know, how come you're not eating your Sprouts on your plate? And you say, I don't like Sprouts. Good answer. They come back 10 minutes later and say, hey man, you still haven't eaten your Sprouts. Why not? Read my lips. Are you hard of hearing or just thick? I hate Sprouts. 20 minutes later, he comes back with his mate, quote, peer group pressure. Hey, Joey, look at this this Janie guy. She's got a Sprout attitude problem. Hey, Janie, how come you're eating the Sprouts? Well, by that point, Janie, you're not going to say, oh, I'm so sorry. How many would you like me to eat? One, two, three. You're going to take the Sprouts and probably put them where the sun doesn't shine on that person. And children need to understand, and we as parents can help them realize that they don't eat things they hate eating, and they shouldn't be drinking things that they really don't want to. They should feel entitled to say no, and teach our children to have easy off-the-cuff answers to this. Oh, no, thanks, mate. I've already had a couple. No, I don't feel like it. All the way up to two fingers up. No, I don't want to. Read my lips. They need to be taught this early on and to feel a sense of entitlement not to have to drink what they don't want to. And they'll realize that actually there's not a problem. Most people might say, hey, go on, have another drink. And that's it. They don't keep going on and on about it. It's a false fear on the part of teenagers. So we need to help them address this so-called peer group pressure, which I think is highly exaggerated. And some medical studies are showing that parental disapproval and parental role modeling can trump peer group pressure. But we're not hearing very much about that. We're told it's all about peer group pressure and we're powerless to deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to know just what any other tips that you would have for parents? It can be quite difficult for, you know, for people like me, and a lot of the people listening to this will have been drinking themselves, but then they've stopped. So there's kind of an element of, oh my goodness, what do I, how do I help my kids and my teenagers now? Because you can't say, don't you do as I ever did, you know, because you know, kids are going to rebel, aren't they? But by the same token, I suppose, I mean, to answer my own question, I suppose you can only hope that they can see the change in you and you're modeling the behavior you want them to have.
Yeah. There's a lot that parents can do. The very, very good news is that by talking to your children and having alcohol rules, this significantly reduces the chance of your children either drinking or binge drinking. Mm. Now, what we're told as parents in Britain is that you better be careful about saying anything. You better be careful about disapproving and prohibiting, because it'll cause a rebellion. It'll elevate alcohol to the status of a mystique. Mm. It's not true. There is no scientific evidence that by prohibiting alcohol, you are more likely to make your children drink or drink more. This is one of those lovely, profitable myths that's been put around by the alcohol industry in England for many, many years. Studies across the world are finding that parents who disapprove of underage drinking and talk to their children about alcohol are far more likely to have children who do not binge drink and are less likely to drink full stop. And even, Janie, when they go off to university, if you ring them up and nag them and say, darling, I've been reading the newspaper about those awful student union bars, and the drunkenness and the vomiting and the sex, it's so awful, please don't binge drink. Well, guess what? Those children at university are less likely to binge drink than if you don't call them up and tell them what you think. This is showing up again and again and again in studies from medical schools. So the main message is your children will sneak behind the bike shed and they will tamper with alcohol. You and I know that. That's very different from them routinely getting drunk and having very high amounts. And so we do have a big influence. And in summary, what I would say to parents listening right now is this: sit your kids down and explain to them that, yes, you or I may have had a lot of alcohol when we were your age. Passive smoking was normal when I was your age. For some parents, driving when you're slightly tipsy was normal, and not having a seatbelt on. Yeah. And also not wearing sun lotion when they were very, very young. There are many health changes that have taken place because medicine knows more about something. And this one is about alcohol. So please don't do what I did. We didn't know about it then. And talk to your kids and show them some evidence, the official positions of, you know, the health authorities on underage drinking, and explain it's not because we don't want you to have a good time. It's not because of antisocial behavior. It's a straightforward health issue. We love you very much, and we don't want anything bad to happen to you. That's why we don't want you drinking until you're this age. And when you do drink, please don't overdo it on the night, because there are consequences for girls' eggs, genetic changes in their eggs, and for both male and female brains, particularly the areas that are good for school grades, the hippocampus, very important for memory and learning. Those things shrink with binge drinking. So these are the reasons. It's not because your dad and I, your mom and I disapprove of it. There are straightforward medical reasons. Have that talk, disapprove, keep your fingers crossed. You know, this is England, they're going to sneak behind the pike shed and do it, but your words will temper the excesses. And that's the best we can really do about it.
Yeah, that's great. I really appreciate that, you know, because you're absolutely right. There are so many parents that are scared of their own shadow, and they don't feel that any of their words will mean anything. So I really appreciate you just saying, yes, actually, do tell them the truth and how you feel. And do tell them, you know, that you care about them.
I have to tell you, Janie, that in absolutely in the number of areas that I do for health education, you know, whether it's dealing with drugs or alcohol or too much screen time or underage pregnancy or sex, time and time again, the same message comes through from medical schools, quietly studying these things with no money and no corruption. And they're finding the really good news for all of us parents is that we parents have a huge influence on our children. They're just not going to thank us for it. They're not going to say, oh, gee, Janie, gee, mommy, thank you so much for disapproving of my social media, of my drinking, of my Canada smoking. They're not going to say that to you. Their job is to be teenagers. But it does have an influence. So the things we say, the rules we have, and our role modeling are now thought by medical schools to have a huge impact on what our children do, not just now, but for the rest of their life. And that's a very good thing.
Mm, really is. So, Arik, just give us your website in case anyone's interested. I mean, I can highly recommend you as a speaker in schools, both to my kids remember your talk. You're an incredibly engaging speaker, and you know, anyone who can get this kind of stuff across to kids is fantastic. So just give us your website.
Right. It is my name, so it would be ariksigmund.com. It's A for Alpha, R-I-C. SIGMAN.com. And there's more information about alcohol and other things on that website.
Great. Thank you. And your book, the book referring to this anyway, is Alcohol Nation. You can still get hold of that. Arik, I really appreciate you sharing this topic with us. Thank you.
So for those of you who are parents, or this is a particular interest of yours, I have also recorded two other very special interviews with Dr. Arik Sigmund around children and teenagers, around self-esteem, body image, and around preventing mental health issues. Actually, the stuff he talks about is relevant for us all. I'll let you know when you can access those interviews. I probably won't run them on the podcast, but there'll be opportunity for you to listen to them separately. So I really hope you'll enjoy those when they come forth as well. As promised, we're bringing you this episode with binary drinks. So check out this interview with Danielle.
Sometimes you come across a drink that is just so unusual and you think, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to like it, but I love it. And we're talking binary. And I'm really pleased that Danielle Becker is my guest. And I'll leave you to describe what binary is, Danielle. Just do that first and then we'll get into a bit about your story.
So binary is a very unusual beer because I think, in my humble opinion, I think beer's done a great job in terms of creating great low and no alcohol offerings. And I think some other categories still need to sort of catch up. But if you're not normally a beer drinker and you're not drinking and you don't like things that are bitter, your kind of options are quite limited. So we're calling it the wine lover's beer. Mm. Doesn't taste at all like a traditional beer. You sort of have to taste it to believe it.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Yeah, so it really is a very light and aromatic and tangy beer designed to go well with food and does really well with people who normally would say, oh, I don't like beer, and then they try it and then they like it.
That's exactly my situation. I almost didn't try it because I thought, no, I've never drank beer. I'm not going to start now. But it's very unusual and really, really lovely drink. Anyways, let's talk a little bit about your story then and what led you to want to produce this. I'm guessing you were a beer drinker.
Yes, and I'm a sort of chemical engineer and I'm a master brewer, so I'm clearly someone who does enjoy beer, but I've never enjoyed having beer with food. So what would happen is then you'd have a meal and then you'd end up, you know, changing to either something more alcoholic, like a glass of wine, or going to something non-alcoholic, like a lime and soda or something like that, but neither of them felt particularly, you know, enjoyable. So the original idea was to come up with something that genuinely pairs well with food. That was the whole inspiration. And then as time's gone on, actually I've become quite passionate about moderation and drinking less and really trying to come up with adult drinks which people can enjoy. And so that was the whole idea, to come up with something like that. And there's no point in coming up with another non-alcoholic beer because there's loads of those around. So just trying to develop something which was sort of owned a unique space, which was this pairs well with food wine alternative.
Mm, yeah. And you, am I right in thinking that you had your own, did you have cancer? You had an illness, didn't you, that took you off alcohol for a while too?
It did. And that was funny because, you know, obviously I didn't drink at all during that time. And when it came back, just didn't want to drink. It's very strange. So, you know, I think a lot of people, when they stop drinking or drink less, there's an event or a something which
triggers it
that direction. And I just didn't want to go back to drinking, but equally I didn't want to drink orange juice or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, so there was a real incentive to try and find, that's probably what made me so much more passionate about moderation, really, was, you know, if you're not drinking, it doesn't mean you should have to compromise.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So how did you go about, you know, choosing how to create this product then? What's different about it? What, you know, talk to me about ingredients and stuff. Not that I would probably understand them very much.
So I think the first thing we did very differently with this beer is that we use a wine yeast. And wine yeast gives it a lot of those sort of tropical fruit flavors and stuff that you wouldn't normally associate with beer. And although I know it's a podcast, I'm going to show you some of the leaves here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. The little hops.
These are the hop leaves.
Hop leaves.
Yeah. So normally the leaves get thrown away at harvest and they'll be turned into compost or something. But actually, you know, leaves play such an important role in our lives. You know, we have them in tea, we eat them in food and all this sort of thing. So the whole thing was all, why not try the hop leaves themselves? And they're great. You infuse them into the beer and you get this lovely tanginess, but without the bitterness of a normal beer. And that's the thing that makes it the most different. So we don't add a lot of hops because women in particular have a physiologically a lower bitterness tolerance generally. And but so that was what the whole idea of adding the leaves into the beer, like a tea infusion.
So these are organic hop leaves from Worcester, is that right? Okay. And tell us why it's called Binary then, because that's all kind of, it's got a really cool reason behind it as well.
Yes. So it's a useless, trivial suit fact probably. So if anyone ever gets asked that, but where grapes grow on a vine, hops grow on a bine. And so the twirly structure that the hops grow on is called a bine, and that's where the name Binary came from. And I am slightly, I suppose, geeky, so we thought, well, you know, the alcoholic version would be one and the non-alcoholic version would be zero, but like binary numbering system.
Right. Okay, cool.
Binary came from, yes.
So we should say that you have one that is completely alcohol-free. That's 0%, is that right? The 0% one? Yeah. And then you have one that's, tell me about the other ones, that 4%, so that would be for people who want tell us the point of the 4%. I'm guessing, I mean, I've never really looked into this market, but I'm guessing there is a market of lower alcohol drinks.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, to be honest. The one I'm the most passionate about is the 0%, because I think, you know, as I said, options for people choosing not to drink at all. But it was a lot more difficult for us to get the recipe right for that. Because I think, as you know, there's a lot of really bad non-alcoholic products out there. And that's just because they're much more difficult to make. So we launched with a 4% first as a low alcohol alternative to a glass of wine. So if you're looking to moderate, you know, switch the 12 or 13% alcohol for the 4%. And we get a lot of people doing that saying, you know, there's an option for someone looking to drink less,
start to reduce or whatever. Yeah,
yes, and start on that sort of journey towards moderation. Whereas then when we launched the 0% last year, it's been fascinating because we had such an uplift in sales in dry January and we thought that would stop, but it's actually continued. And it's like people start and then they realize, oh, actually this is I can drink less or not at all, and it, you know, sales have continued.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something lovely about you. I mean, your packaging is lovely, the name, that's something lovely about just that cool bottle. It's it's a great brand. We ought to also say that it's vegan and gluten-free. How important was that for you? Because again, I have a few people that I've connected with who've said they want to try the non-alcoholic beers, but they're certainly not all gluten-free.
No, they're not. So I think there's a particular enzyme that you can add into beer, which is what most of the commercial beers do, which makes it gluten-free. It's quite expensive, but it's the best way to ensure that you have a gluten-free beer, and each one is tested. And so it's really important for people looking for gluten-free. Vegan, the reason we went for a vegan beer, to be fair, a lot of beers are vegan, but what we did is we had it registered with the Vegan Society. And I can have said, having gone through the process, so I think if you see that little vegan logo, you know, it's rigorous.
Yeah, absolutely. And then tell us about the kind of calorific value, you know, how, because I did notice it doesn't taste as sweet as some, you know, alcohol-free drinks.
That was my main thing. I can't stand the fact. So my view on non-alcoholic products is, if it's something that my children would be prepared to drink, it's not an adult drink.
Yeah, that's a really good marker, actually.
That's my story. And I feel like, you know, as you get older, your taste buds mature and you're looking for something a bit more interesting. And sweet's not necessarily one of those dimensions. Mm. So we wanted something which is really not sweet at all, plus, you know, almost quite sour, not sour, but, you know, something which is a bit more challenging for the adult palate. So the non-alcoholic, which is in a 250ml bottle, is 45 calories for the bottle. So literally, if you can have a, you know, two blocks of chocolate, or you could have a whole drink. Hmm. And, you know, I always think what you're drinking should never be the main attraction. It should be what you're eating. So why would you want to drink your calories? So you want something that complements your meal, but isn't the star. So, you know, it should have a role, it should taste delicious, but it shouldn't consume your calories.
Well, we hear of the classic beer belly, don't we? And people who drink, it can be incredible. I mean, I think many of us forget actually just how much, you know, we consume in terms of sugar, or what converts to sugar in the body when we're drinking.
Absolutely.
And then of course, when we ditch the booze, I was certainly shocked and horrified that I didn't lose loads of weight in the first 2 weeks. Funnily enough, it doesn't work like that. Never mind. So where do you sell Binary? Is it, you know, in normal times in any bars or pubs or restaurants, or is it only online?
So we found that we're typically doing better with the product in sort of fine dining, food pairing, or sort of kind gastro pubs, because it really is a beer for food. Drink it out of a wine glass, you know, with the whole theatre and ritual that goes with that. And then we're online in Ocado, Amazon, our own website, and independent wine shops. Typically, actually better in wine-led shops.
That's good.
I think this is not a beer aimed at beer drinkers. So in a craft beer sort of environment, it gets lost. And if you really like your IPAs and your bitter products, this is not going to be the beer for you.
Yeah. How do you see, you must have seen the industry change massively. I mean, for you as someone who was involved in brewing, how has it been? It must have been incredible, because over the last couple of years, the rise in alcohol-free drinks generally, for guys in your industry, it must be incredible.
It is incredible. I think the industry's done a brilliant job personally. I think, you know, I mean, I've been involved in beer and beer innovation for over 20 years now. So was involved in making some of the earlier non-alcoholic beers a really long time ago.
Which weren't very nice, I hear. No offense.
And I think with technology improvements and recipe improvements and all that sort of thing, some of the products that you taste now, they don't even taste alcohol free. They're just a delicious drink. It's not a grudge purchase. And I think if you can move on from something being a positive choice as opposed to a grudge purchase, then you know the industry's moved on. And I think when you read some of the reviews of some of the low or no beers online, where people are saying didn't even miss the alcohol, then you know you've done a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's you know, there's a few markets here, aren't there, for you guys. But I think that, you know, one of the most interesting things that I've seen is that, of course, I connect with many people like me who would drinking too much and didn't have an off switch and something needs to change. So the fact that there are incredible alcohol-free drinks is just such an amazing bonus. But then there are other people like my husband who barely drank at all, but had an off switch, one of those people who could have a drink or not have a drink. It really wasn't an issue.
Yes.
So, he wouldn't kind of need to choose to be alcohol free, because it's not a thing. He doesn't even think about it. It's like, do I have to choose whether to stop eating bananas? No, not really, because I don't eat too many.
No.
So it was exactly the same for him. But what's been so fascinating is that because there's been alcohol free drinks in the house and obviously no alcohol, he's kind of started on the alcohol free drinks and has just decided, well, these are better. So I don't need alcohol anymore, like at all ever. So it's you've taken a market that you probably didn't even know you had, as it were, which is amazing, isn't it? And that's what you're doing, I suppose, with your products. It's a really amazing drink, irrespective of what you're.
And I think once we get that right, then the industry will get it. Because I think I was thinking about even veganism. You know, a few years ago, your options were the Linda McCartney.
Yeah. And exactly.
I don't think they're very nice. But now I'm not a vegan, but I try and reduce my meat consumption. I actively choose out some of the new products that are out there because they're just delicious.
Exactly, exactly.
Not they're meat free.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's when we look forward to the time when to not drink is as normal as to drink. that's a bit of a double negative, but you know what I mean. Yeah. So, if I interview you in a year's time, then how what would you like to have seen happen for your brand and for the market generally?
So I suppose our company ethos is live lighter. So that's live lighter with yourself, make healthier choices, live lighter on the planet, and live lighter with how you engage with people. So enjoy those everyday moments of spending time with friends and all this sort of thing. And so, you know, in my ideal world, the non-alcoholic version has done amazingly and we've brought more people onto it. And hopefully then some new brands will come onto the mix, which are all around whole plant consumption, waste products, botanical infusions to create a range of more interesting non-alcoholic drinks, which are targeted for the adult palate. So if in a year's time we've introduced the next version of something non-alcoholic, which is botanical in nature, ideally using a waste stream of some sort, and it tastes good, then we've done a good job.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I really appreciate it, Danielle. Thank you so much. And well done you on creating such a fantastic brand. And let's hope all that comes true, right? And we'll speak again in a year, if not
before.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And you can win a case of Binary Drinks if you go to thesoberclub.com, click on blogs, you'll see that you can win it there. Or if you go to imperfectlynatural.com, that's my kind of sister site where I do more of the health and wellbeing stuff, you'll see that competition there as well. And again, I'll pop it in the show notes as well as the link to the free mini ebook, which is called How to Get and Stay Sober During Lockdown. So I've given you quite a lot of info this week. I hope I haven't totally overwhelmed you. Don't forget, if you are struggling, do reach out for help. Please don't feel you're alone at this time. It's so difficult for so many people in lots of different ways. So remember those recommendations from Alain de Botton and do reach out for help. And you know how to find me at Janie Lee Grace on Instagram and on Facebook and Twitter. Obviously, you can check out thesoberclub.com. We would love to have you join us in our very supportive, literally amazing community. And I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.